opportunity to feel safe, seek refuge in, and find solace has all been shattered and taken away from us by one night's act of hatred and abuse. On what needs to be done to protect Muslim communities in their places of worship, Muhammad said, "We need more media coverage, more support and allies. More funding needs to be allocated towards protection of mosques and its users. We also need CCTV, fencing and security guards." Blood Still Stains, Part 1.
If anyone sees the blood on the wall and torn clothes, he would understand that a catastrophic event took place here.
Tonight, they became the gates to hell. Suicide bombings have claimed numerous lives.
ISIS has claimed responsibility for the attack there in Afghanistan.
August 26th, 2021, Kabul Airport. One of the deadliest terrorist attacks in Afghanistan. 169 Afghans lost their lives in a terrorist attack at two gates, Karzai International Airport. This attack exactly coincided with the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. This deadly attack is just one example of the massacres that terrorists committed in Afghanistan. This bloodbath will never end. America's Response Monument in New York City, a statue of an American soldier on horseback. Many people think that this statue is related to the American Civil Wars in the 19th century or to World War II, but surprisingly, it is related to the 21st century and the presence of American troops in Afghanistan.
And there's a picture of them on horseback.
But why U.S. Special Forces rode horses in Afghanistan? These soldiers were actually security forces from the CIA and the Pentagon, who, in the early days of the occupation of Afghanistan, were responsible for providing intelligence support to the Afghan proxy forces, along with carrying out airstrikes. He is Robert L. Grenier, the former director of the CIA Counterterrorism Center and author of 88 Days to Kandahar, a CIA diary. He believes that the U.S. proxy war against the Taliban started in 2001.
We quickly determined that the best way forward was for us to leverage relationships with Afghans on the ground who could do what we could not over the long term, and that is to deny their country. And because CIA had those relationships, people were looking to CIA to actually lead this effort. And so that put me in a very, very unique position.
Operational Detachment Alpha, ODA 595, with the leadership of David Tyson, CIA's top agent. This group entered northern Afghanistan by helicopter from the Karshi-Khanabad K2 airbase. The mission of this group was to conduct unconventional warfare in support of an Afghan person named Abdulrashid Dostum.
The real power base in northern Afghanistan is around Mazar-e-Sharif, and the man who controls that region is Abdulrashid Dostum. The Americans showed up around October. So when an A-team goes in, they have a mission, and this one just said support Dostum. You'd see Dostum with his turban, the warlord, and then you'd see these two guys wearing turbans and Oakley sunglasses sitting next to him, the CIA. So it's almost like the man who would be king, you know?
Finally, the CIA, with full support of proxy forces, captured the most important city in northern Afghanistan, Mazar-e-Sharif. It happened after a face-to-face battle. Same time in southern Afghanistan, Operational Detachment Alpha, the OTA 574, a group of 12 members, transferred another Afghan ally to Afghanistan by support of the CIA center in Pakistan. Team 574 entered Afghanistan from the south. This team, led by Jason, a Marine, supported Karzai. They wanted to occupy Kandahar, the last city under the control of the Taliban. Karzai led the tribes around Kandahar to rise up against the Taliban.
Support tribal leaders in the Pashtun south of Afghanistan who were willing to rise up against the Taliban. And we tried to turn Afghanistan, I would argue, into something that it was not.
Finally, the Americans captured Kandahar with Karzai's support. Karzai and Abdulrashid Dostum were key figures in the first days of the U.S. invasion. The CIA continuously triggered proxy wars in Afghanistan after 2001. The all-out attacks of the Western countries and the capture of all Afghan cities made the Taliban forces retreat to remote mountains and villages. Mullah Muhammad Omar reorganized the Taliban. After a short period of retreat, he started the Taliban movement from a small school of thought in Singhasar, Kandahar. Gradually started small uprisings against the occupying forces. In 2006, the Taliban could retake control of the significant parts of Afghanistan thanks to irregular warfare campaigns, a process that continued year after year. They thought about negotiations with some of Mullah Muhammad Omar's deputies after the failure of conventional wars against the Taliban and the increase in the West's military expenses.
The logic was, if you can't win the war militarily, then you'll have to win it through politics, through negotiations, through diplomacy, through some kind of political settlement. And year after year, military efforts were resourced over diplomatic and negotiating efforts. The book does describe a very fascinating secret negotiation between the Obama administration and the head of the Taliban's political commission at the time, Tayyip Aga.
The negotiations were conducted to change Mullah Muhammad Omar's mind, but they were fruitless.
An American invasion, we were hoping that that would cause Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, to change his mind. He did not change his mind. And so I worked very hard in two long meetings with his deputy to try to convince him to push Mullah Omar aside and do what his chief could not.
In this situation, it was expected the U.S. would adopt a new policy.
Today I signed a historic agreement between the United States and Afghanistan, we will complete our mission and end the war in Afghanistan. By the end of 2014, the Afghans will be fully responsible for the security of their country.
In this regard, Hamid Karzai and Barack Obama signed an agreement called the Strategic Partnership Agreement in 2012. The American forces handed over security responsibilities of Afghanistan to local security forces for 2 years. A small number of remaining American soldiers started training and supporting the Afghan army. On December 28, 2014, NATO seemingly ended its military operations. Number of American troops in Afghanistan decreased a lot compared to the past. When NATO forces couldn't stop the Taliban, how could the Afghan army fight against them? But the West's plan to prevent the advance of the Taliban did not end here, because there was a more important issue on the table. In the process of peace negotiations, when the Afghan political delegation met with the Pakistani and sometimes American officials, John Kerry provided Karzai with classified information about Mullah Muhammad Omar's whereabouts and movements. The American and Pakistani officials continue providing the classified information for Karzai during the years of peace negotiations. According to Asim Salim Bajwa, a former spokesman of the Pakistan Army, Karzai knew about Mullah Muhammad Omar's death during his visit to Pakistan in 2013. Of course, this news remained a secret until 2015 and the new government of Afghanistan under the presidency of Ashraf Ghani. On July 15, 2015, Abdul Hasib Sadegh, the former spokesman of Afghanistan's General Directorate of National Security, officially announced that Mullah Muhammad Omar died in a hospital in Karachi, Pakistan. But what was the motivation to keep it a secret, and on the other hand, to publish this news suddenly and publicly? This news was published exactly 1 day before talks between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan. This action was defined based on the policy to control the Taliban. Michael Kugelman, the Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center.
This will certainly impact peace talks between the Taliban and the Afghan government, because it'll be very difficult for the Taliban to focus on talks when it's going through a leadership crisis.
They thought the Taliban faced a leadership crisis and it could affect their unity in negotiations. And finally, the Taliban's advances in Afghanistan were also controlled after the collapse of negotiations.
Not to get fixated on a characterization of the Taliban that fits your own view of what you need to do. So if you are advocating a strategy of splintering and peeling away, you're going to naturally look for fissures in the organization and lack of cohesion in the organization.
Splintering the Taliban was the best way to weaken this organization. The announcement of the death of the founder of the Taliban gave an opportunity to the people who were previously expelled from the organization by Mullah Omar. Later, they were used to weaken the Taliban. Mullah Muhammad Omar had fired some Taliban leaders in the past due to violations of the rules. Mansur Dadullah was Mullah Dadullah's brother. Mullah Omar dismissed him from the Taliban organization because of his insubordination in negotiations with foreign parties and involvement in the assassination of Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Mullah Muhammad Omar also dismissed Abdul Manan Niazi due to extensive financial corruption.
since the death of Mullah Omar, we have seen the Taliban have become increasingly decentralized, both horizontally and vertically. They have also become relatively incoherent. They have also splintered across different factions and groups that are now operating under different flags and different leaders.
In this situation, the media added flame to the fire.
Mullah Omar, I mean, we've had reports that he might be dead many times before. What does it tell us, if indeed these reports are correct, that he has indeed been dead for 2 years?
On the flip side, people like General John F. Campbell, former commander of the Resolute Support Mission and United States Forces, Afghanistan, instill doubt and ambiguity in the Afghan society.
You know, a couple weeks, middle of July time frame, when the announcement of Mullah Omar's death came out, you got to think to yourselves, you know, he's been dead for 2 years. Why didn't the regular Taliban know about that? Somebody that was deceiving everybody. I think what's happening right now is they're trying to figure out who is going to lead the Taliban. Is it Mansour? Is it Zakir? Is it Yaqub? Is it Manan?
And Amrullah Saleh, former head of the National Security Directorate, the NDS, of Afghanistan. In such a critical situation, the Taliban Supreme Council appointed Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour as the new leader. Under the leadership of Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour, some Taliban leaders reopened old wounds. Tayyip Aga was the head of the Taliban's political office in Doha, Qatar. Sayyid Mohammad Tayyip Aga resigned after Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour came to power and left the world of politics. But not all the disaffected members of the Taliban took the same measures. In some cases, they used weapons and started wars. Mullah Mohammad Rasool's insurgency was the most important sign of the beginning of a war against the Taliban. In a strange way, the BBC covered this meeting that was held in the outskirts of Herat. On November 10th, 2015, Mullah Mohammad Rasool officially announced himself as leader of the Taliban in a big meeting in Herat. He could have many followers afterwards. Mullah Mohammad Rasool and his supporters basically didn't consider Mullah Akhtar Mansour to be the leader of the Taliban. Mullah Mohammad Rasool appointed Abdul Manan Niazi and Mansour Dadullah as the deputies of provinces in the west and south of Afghanistan. Mansour Dadullah entered into direct military conflict with the new leader, Mullah Akhtar Mansour. In 2015, Mansour Dadullah was killed in Zabul province in the conflict with the Taliban. Mullah Mansour Dadullah's death marked the end of the activities of rebel groups in southern Afghanistan. Mullah Akhtar Mansour's forces concentrated on Herat to destroy the western faction of the insurgent movements led by Abdul Manan Niazi. In 2016, Mullah Akhtar Mansour decided to put down the rebellion once and for all. But the U.S. directly intervened to defend Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. In 2016, Mullah Akhtar Mansour, former leader of the Taliban, was assassinated in a U.S. drone strike. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, in collaboration with the Afghan government, decided to kill him.
Mansour was a threat to that effort, and this action sends a clear message to the world that we will continue to stand with our Afghan partners.
The Taliban Central Council appointed Habibullah Akhundzada as the new leader after the assassination of Mullah Akhtar Mansour. Under the leadership of Hibatullah Akhundzada, the conflict between Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi and the Taliban continued. After 2016, Mullah Mohammad Rasool's forces had only one main and serious faction that was led by Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi in the provinces from the southwest to the northwest. In 5 to 6 years of his leadership, Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi was able to attract the loyalty of some of the Afghan tribes and fight against the Taliban. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi called Khunzada a mercenary and dependent person. He called the forces under the leadership of Mullah Hibatullah Khunzada as fake Taliban supporters and soldiers of fortune. On the contrary, he called his organization the Supreme Council of the Taliban and considered himself as the true successor of Mullah Omar. He also considered himself as the future Amirul Mu'mineen of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. War with all of Afghanistan's neighbors does not match any political logic. He also criticized and complained about the countries of the region that were occupied by the U.S. or its allies. In this situation, he never criticized Saudi Arabia, Israel, or the Daesh terrorist group. But we don't know who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. The New York Times, in an article published on June 19, 2017, explained in detail who exactly supported Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi. This article suggested the Afghan intelligence agency paid each member of this group salaries equivalent to $150 to $300 a month to fight against the Taliban and Afghanistan's neighbors.
The splinter Taliban groups and lower level commanders from the main movement, which would be the Afghan Taliban or the Quetta Shura, and from the battlefield, and slowly integrate them into the Afghan government. And this would bring or pressure the Taliban top leadership.
In the battlefield, when Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi's forces were under pressure, the Afghan army helped them and took the wounded soldiers to government hospitals for treatment. Mullah Abdul Manan Niazi had also mentioned his cooperation with the Afghan army. In fact, the secret cooperation between the Afghan government and Abdul Manan Niazi was a plan to weaken and destroy the Taliban. But this tragedy failed, and Mullah Manan Niazi was eventually killed in a clash with the Taliban in Herat. Although he claimed to be an invincible leader, his death broke the chain of this breakaway faction in western Afghanistan.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight. Palestinian prisoners in different prisons of the Zionist regime have started protests against the continuous mistreatment by Israeli prison officials. Due to the insistence of the Israeli occupying regime on its cruel and vengeful measures with the aim of destroying the Palestinian organizational institutions, the Palestinian prisoners have started an indefinite hunger strike. Other groups of prisoners have assured to join this hunger strike in the coming days. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at their detention. The Israeli regime's jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under terrible conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian prisoners have also been subject to systematic torture, to harassment and repression. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media for further details. Please stay with us. MondoWeiss.net wrote, on Tuesday, 6th of September, more than 400 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons entered their 13th consecutive day of punitive measures imposed on them by the Israel Prison Services, or IPS, including being locked in their prison cells and denied recreational yard time, all due to alleged affiliations with Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. These repressive measures are also a response to prisoner protest and disobedience, which has reignited the battle of the Palestinian prisoner movement inside Israeli prisons. On 1st of September, almost 10 days after launching a collective civil disobedience movement in Israeli prisons, Palestinian political detainees were planning on going on a collective hunger strike in the light of these punitive and retaliatory measures. Just a day before, on 31st of August, Khalil Awada ended his hunger strike of 182 days protesting his illegal imprisonment by Israeli authorities without charge and without trial. Khalil Awada is expected to be released on 2nd of October of this year following his hunger strike's victory. Over 7,000 Palestinians are documented to be imprisoned by Israel, including 32 Palestinian women and 175 Palestinian children and minors. Many Palestinian detainees are either arrested by the military in overnight raids that collectively terrorize entire neighborhoods or entire villages and towns, or are arrested at military checkpoints, which are guarded by heavily armed Israeli soldiers. Palestinian political detainees are regularly exposed to systematic mechanisms of abuse, mistreatment, and torture. Palestinian political detainees have been warning against the abuses practiced by the Israeli prison service ever since the Gilboa prison break of September 2021. Palestinian political detainees recognize that Israeli practices against them continue to escalate and intensify. In the light of these conditions, they have reoriented towards a new strategy of unity across political factions. The anti-war website elaborated more about the story, saying, according to the Palestinian Commission on Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, around 1 million Palestinians were imprisoned between 1967 and 2021. Currently, hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees are held in Israeli prisons, an act that violates international law on various counts. Holding prisoners without trial and without due process, and transferring prisoners to enemy territories, the latter being a stark violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. Of course, respecting international law has never been Israel's strongest suit. In fact, the Israeli regime continues to deliberately ignore international law in numerous aspects of its illegal military occupation of Palestine, rationalizing such actions on security grounds. Palestinians are also doing what they do best, resist under the harshest of conditions and by every means available to them. Tellingly, the strongest of such resistance takes place inside prison walls by gaunt-looking and often dying Palestinian hunger strikers. This latest battle has become known among prisoners under the slogan of Unity in Confronting the Jailer, and is being run by a higher emergency committee, which is notably different from how past campaigns have operated, in that they were coordinated through factional heads. According to a spokesperson of the Palestinian Prisoners Society, the most prominent decision to emerge from the emergency committee was the announcement that 1,000 Palestinian detainees would go on hunger strike. This was a measure of last resort, a strategy of pressuring the Israeli prison service to heed Palestinian demands. Palestinian Wafa news agency had this to say. The Israeli colonial regime continues to hold Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in military prisons after being tried in military courts. Palestinians from the city of Al-Quds and those with Israeli citizenship face discriminatory treatment in Israeli civil courts, which criminalize them because they are Palestinians, and they're considered demographic threats and threats to Israel's national security. Most Palestinian prisoners, including minors and children, are arrested, detained, and illegally transferred across occupied territory into Israeli prisons, a violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. Prisoners are often isolated from the outside world by the Israeli Prison Service, the IPS, by denying family visitation, limiting access to educational materials and television, and sometimes illegally putting them in solitary confinement. Moreover, human rights experts, international medical staff, and other officials are prevented from visiting these Palestinian prisoners, effectively imposing a humanitarian and a media blackout in the Israeli prisons. Many prisoners are sentenced based on coerced confessions, which are obtained by Israeli interrogators through systematic use of physical and psychological torture, including the use of violence, the use of threats, intimidation, stress positions, sleep deprivation, being put in extremely cold or extremely hot conditions, and blackmail. However, even without confessions or substantiated evidence, Israeli military courts can still arbitrarily hold Palestinians without trial and without a charge, under the provisions of so-called administrative detention. Palestinian detainees are often placed under conditions that leave them with psychological scars, not only making it difficult to endure the prison, but also making reintegration into their communities post-release even more complicated. The heaviest impact is on Palestinian children, who can be treated with a criminality that violates their rights as children. For this reason, Palestinian political detainees continue to battle Israeli colonialism and apartheid from inside their prison cells. Strategies like hunger strikes are used as a last resort to push for negotiations with the Israeli prison service for better living conditions. Often these are bare minimum demands, such as access to family calls, to yard time, and entry of goods.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Fighting has erupted again in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region, ending hopes for peace after a ceasefire declared in March ended in tatters. Many Ethiopians believe Western powers are backing Tigray rebels who restarted the war. Ethiopians have held protests across the world, calling on Washington to stop its support for TPLF rebels.
It is very critical. It's an issue of the country. And we don't need America to interfere in Ethiopians' issue. Actually, we don't need, and we don't need any support. America must stay away. USA must stay away from the issue of Ethiopia. Because of them, we are suffering now. Our country is getting finished. People are dying, and our economy is getting finished. Therefore, it's because of America. America must stop. America must raise his hand, pick his hand back, and America must stay away. It's because of them, they entered in our country, interfering, causing problem, causing fighting. No, because of them, we are suffering. Therefore, wherever we live, America is supporting TPLF.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on renewed fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region amid reports that some Western powers are supporting the rebels in this Horn of Africa nation. We are asking, why are foreign powers and some regional countries backing the rebels in Ethiopia? The second part of our show today will be on the move by the European Parliament to oppose the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline, a move that has angered the people of Uganda. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects. You can also be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Western powers backing Ethiopia rebels. The people of Ethiopia are once again witnessing renewed fighting between government forces and Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF rebels. Fighting erupted late August, shattering a five-month truce aimed at ending the 21-month conflict in Africa's second most populous nation. The TPLF ruled Ethiopia for 27 years before it ousted in 2018 following anti-government protests across the country. Abiy Ahmed took over as prime minister after the ouster of the TPLF. Now, Abiy's government accuses the TPLF of attempting to reassert Tigrayan dominance over Ethiopia.
Foreign powers that back TPLF during its rule over Ethiopia have been accused of supporting this party, which is now a rebel group. During a rally to denounce foreign backers of TPLF rebels, the mayor of Addis Ababa vowed that the rebels will never succeed.
After a sacrifice paid, those people of ours have left us the freedom you're enjoying today. We can never have a drop of patience to tolerate those who attempt to take that freedom away from us. The TPLF junta, the terrorist group, has waged war on us at the time when we started a new era, forgetting the atrocities and crimes it has committed over the last 27 years. They will never succeed.
Well, for more on the current situation in Ethiopia, we contacted Yolian Ogbu, an independent political writer and commentator. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Western countries have been accused of backing Tigray rebels in northern Ethiopia. If that is the case, what is the objective of Western powers in destabilizing Ethiopia?
TPLF has had a long-standing relationship with the West. For about 30 years, from 1991 to 2018, TPLF has ruled with an iron fist. They've opened up so many conversations and talks around the United States investing in natural resources within Ethiopia. And as we're seeing this kind of shift that China has had more of an influence in the Horn, it's definitely like a lot of a reason to believe that TPLF has become a prize for United States and for Europe to kind of come in and wreak havoc and chaos in Ethiopia until their buddies are back in power again. Dr. Abiy Ahmed, the current prime minister of Ethiopia, has made it very clear that he wants to have peace talks within the Horn and engage in political and economic integration cooperation. And that's just simply something that the West is not interested in, and that kind of ruins their unilateral influence. So that's really why they're backing the Tigray rebels in northern Ethiopia.
Ethiopia has also raised complaints about foreign support for TPLF, with a finger pointing at neighboring Sudan. There are also reports that Egypt might be backing these rebels. It is believed that Egypt and Sudan are backing TPLF rebels due to their differences with the current government in Addis Ababa over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam.
As we understand why they're interested in backing the Tigray rebels specifically, it's because they too have a stake in making sure that TPLF is back in power, or at least destabilizes Ethiopia in some way, specifically because we've seen conversations and arguments really back and forth between Egypt and Ethiopia as it relates to the Grand Renaissance Dam, the creation of that, how that goes into commodifying a natural resource like water in and of itself. And so the arguments about kind of who owns this resource and who gets what is really all being stoked by the West. And so because the West has such a great relationship with Egypt's leadership as well as Sudan, given the recent controversies and coup that happened in Sudan as well, this is all kind of part of this three-pronged plan for the U.S. to, again, make sure that it has that unilateral influence on the Horn.
Ethiopia has rejected a report by United Nations investigators that accused Addis Ababa of possible ongoing crimes against humanity in its war-torn Tigray region, including using starvation as a weapon. Ethiopia's permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva has categorically denounced the UN report.
The Commission has submitted a report of substandard quality. Its allegations are unsubstantiated and not meeting the standard of proof for such investigations. It has fallen prey to those well accustomed to deceiving bodies of this nature. This practice of targeting countries like Ethiopia ultimately undermines the authority and the credibility of the Human Rights Council. Without doubt, the report is selective and discriminatory, and its conclusions are politically motivated.
Now, after listening to the Ethiopian ambassador at the United Nations in Geneva, do you think Addis Ababa is justified in rejecting this UN report?
I think we have to be honest about what it means to be involved in a war and in a crisis, right? And so on both sides, there's definitely going to be killings. There's definitely has been mass suffering. So I think what's interesting about this particular report and why I definitely have reason to believe why the government really feels as though it's biased is because nowhere does it even talk about TPLF's crimes that it has committed. What's interesting is that they make it seem as though the Eritrean and Ethiopian government, as well as like local Amhara militias, are the reasons as to why this war has been waged, and that they're fighting against Tigray people and really attempting to quote unquote exterminate them, which is baseless because we're seeing extrajudicial killings all over the country, whether you are Oromo, Amhara.
The Ethiopian government and Tigrayan rebels failed to progress in peace talks, and renewed fighting broke out between the two sides late August. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was deeply shocked and saddened by the news of the resumption of hostilities in Ethiopia.
I am deeply shocked and saddened by the news of the resumption of hostilities in Ethiopia. Ethiopians, Tigrayans, Amharas, Oromos, Afars have already suffered too much.
The Western-backed TPLF rebels have been blamed for the deadlock in the Ethiopia peace process, amid concern that many lives will be lost if the conflict continues.
It's really the Tigray authorities. TPLF is the main reason as to why we haven't really seen any progress with those peace talks. Because on June 14th, the Ethiopian government, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, had signaled this possibility that his government's going to hold peace talks with TPLF, to which TPLF had made it very clear in the media that they had rejected any of these talks at all. They said peaceful solution is not and has never been an option for Tigray.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, during a recent message to Ethiopians marking the Meskel holiday, said his government has done more than its share to ensure that the current conflict is resolved peacefully. Now, what, in your opinion, is the most practical roadmap for sustainable peace in Ethiopia?
So that really depends on one's definition of peace. I think for me, it is very clear that peace in the Horn, as it relates to Ethiopia as well, is political, economic cooperation and independence from the West, like in terms of their ties to NGOs and such. The only way that's going to happen is this support and cooperation from other neighboring countries of Ethiopia. So we're talking Eritrea, Somalia, and so many more. The only way that's really going to happen is one, TPLF has to be gone and dissolved. And I think that unity internally within Ethiopia is necessary as a pretext for working class unity across the Horn in general.
There you have it. Unity of all ethnic groups in Ethiopia is critical if sustainable peace is to be attained in this country. That's the opinion of Yolien Ogboom, an independent political writer and commentator. I would like to thank her for the incisive analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the meddling by the European Union in the East African oil pipeline project. Stay with us.
Uganda slams EU meddling in its oil projects.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The European Union Parliament recently passed a resolution against the East African crude oil pipeline. EU legislators urged Total Energy, a French oil multinational, and its joint venture partners to delay the projects by 1 year to address environmental and human rights concerns.
Total Energies hopes to exploit the oil lying beneath Lake Albert in western Uganda. The East African crude oil pipeline is planned to be a 1,445-kilometer heated pipeline that will transport crude oil from Uganda to the coastal port of Tanga in Tanzania for onward shipment to the international market.
Members of Parliament in Uganda have criticized the European Union Parliament resolution, terming it blatant interference in the country's internal affairs. The Deputy Speaker of the Ugandan Parliament, Thomas Tayebwa, led his parliamentarians in rejecting the EU meddling in the country's oil pipeline project. Now, to discuss the European Union's meddling in the East African crude oil pipeline, we contacted Lawrence Freeman. He's an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
My pleasure to be with you.
What is your take on this audacity by the EU Parliament to issue a resolution against the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline?
The Ugandan Parliament is correct that the European Union and the entire West has adopted this insane policy of a green reset, and it's being used to prevent the continued underdevelopment of Africa. Without energy development, which the African countries have a right to use their own resources for their own industrialization of their nation. And the European Union, along with the United States, are insane on this question that the people are going to cause a burning up of the planet. I mean, not only is this not true, but to the Europeans themselves are buying gas and oil from Africa and from other countries. So it is beyond hypocritical. It's a continuation of the colonial, neo-colonial policy to prevent African nations from fully developing their economic potential.
Uganda's Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Thomas Tayebwa, says the proposed pipeline only represents 0.5% of global emissions. Yet the EU, with just 10% of the world population, emits 20% unfettered, and member countries are exploring plans to deepen fossil fuel-related excavations unfettered. He added that the EU resolution represented the highest level of neocolonialism and imperialism against Uganda and Tanzanian sovereignty.
They're absolutely correct. The individual nations trying to uplift the standard of living of their people, have a right and an actual obligation to use their resources for the development of the people. Africans across the continent, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, die every day because of the lack of electricity. And this is not an exaggeration. Lack of electricity, we don't have food production, we don't have food processing, we don't have energy to keep warm and to keep cold supplies, and therefore people are dying. And therefore it is colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialism, for the West to dictate to African countries. In fact, it may also be racism, that they cannot use their own resources for the development of their own nations, even though it's exactly what the West countries have done.
EU legislators have claimed that developing the East African crude oil pipeline will pose major environmental and climate risks. However, John Habumugisha, the deputy managing director of the East African crude oil pipeline, has given assurance to Ugandans that the project will have no adverse effect on the environment. Now, do you think EU countries really care about the environment? Yet the bloc is now allowing the use of coal, a major pollutant, to combat energy insecurity following the war in Ukraine?
Well, my view is that the climate change has been going on for billions of years since our planet was formed. And I don't consider the current changes in our climate and weather to be the result of human activity. So I don't buy into this whole propaganda that CO2 is the number one enemy of the world. In fact, plants and trees love CO2, and I don't think they would agree with human beings at all on this question. And therefore, the European countries, and of course they're buying oil and gas right now, even as they complain about it, they're buying it from Russia, they're buying it from other countries. There's not going to be any way of easily moving out coal, oil, and gas in the immediate future. And therefore, we should burn every pound of coal, oil, and gas we can to provide energy.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Uganda in July and met with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, where they discussed the issue of rising fuel and food costs in Africa following Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The visit raised concerns in Europe and the United States. Is it likely that Russia's closeness to Uganda might be a contributing factor to EU's opposition to the East African crude oil pipeline?
It could well be. I can't say for sure, but we know that the West, in particular the United States, which is moving towards war with Russia and has already declared China its number one enemy, that the United States views the whole world from its insane, deranged geopolitical doctrine that they must remain on top and all other economic powers must be below them and follow their, quote, rules-based order, end of quote. So it's quite possible.
TotalEnergy has been warned by Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni that if its commitment to the country's $20 billion oil project begins to waver under pressure from the European Union, he will quickly find a new investor.
There is growing concern that the East African crude oil pipeline project might not take off, especially considering the fact that Uganda and Tanzania are relying on Western financial institutions to fund the project. However, Uganda and Tanzania are now considering other options to ensure the project moves forward.
Of course, the project should move forward. I mean, there's a lot of support that's coming from China in terms of long-term low-interest loans. There's loans that are also coming from India, Russia, Turkey, and a few other countries. My approach is that these infrastructure projects, such as the one we're talking about, Uganda, Tanzania Oil, and a whole bunch of other projects, water projects, energy projects, they all have to go ahead. And my view is, and I'm working with people to establish a Africa Infrastructure Development Bank that would actually provide long-term low-interest loans for exactly these kinds of infrastructure projects. Without energy, without infrastructure, without high-speed rail, Africa will not develop. It will not industrialize. I guarantee you that. And therefore, these projects must be fully supported, and the African countries have to organize themselves and mobilize themselves so that they can actually carry out the funding for these projects.
Tanzania's president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, says the East African Pipeline Project will, among other things, alleviate unemployment. Speaking during a visit to Uganda last year to witness the signing of the documents, she termed the event was an auspicious occasion that would unlock the development of the region's oil resources.
Apart from socioeconomic benefits, the project will also stimulate trade, investment, as well as unlocking the East Africa's oil potential, thus attracting more investors. More importantly, this project will strengthen strategic partnership and cooperation between our two brotherly countries, and in addition, it will forge further the regional integration and people's interaction.
Supporters of the East African Crude Oil Pipeline Project say it offers local and long-term solutions to economic challenges in the region and will therefore benefit the people. Now, do you agree with this perception?
Well, I think any time that you're producing energy for the population, that's a benefit. Energy is the most essential infrastructure that Africa, all nations need, and Africa has been deprived of it for hundreds of years. Rail development, high-speed rail, probably second. These kinds of projects are essential. They will lead to growth. They will lead to increasing the quality of life and standard of living of the people.
Well, our guest there says European Union's interference in the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline is tantamount to genocide because it prevents economic progress that is critical in preventing deaths related to poverty. I'd like to thank Lawrence Freeman, as always, for his time. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.